The bigger picture. Going behind the headlines of the biggest economic and political stories of the day.
It is time to talk politics. I've been joined by Mike Indian, the financial commentator, author of the blog The Groucho Tendency. Mike, welcome as ever.
Thank you,
extraordinary politics. Of all the extraordinary things that have happened in the last few months, I have to say the story of Theresa May shedding a tear when she heard the exit poll strikes as being the most bizarre. This is not the Theresa May, I was going to say, we know and love. This is not the Theresa May of our experience at least 6 months ago. So what on earth is happening? Is this designed to make us feel that she really is a human being after all?
Two words, Simon. Belated humility, I think. She's really been encouraged to express some sort of remorse for the election result. And Nick Robinson had a very much maligned tweet on election night about how the PM was wearing a lot of makeup and how she looked like she was visibly quite upset at the count at Maidenhead on June 8th/9th. But now she's given an interview to Radio 5 Live where she's basically opened up and said, actually, yes, the exit poll, when I heard about it from my husband Philip, it did actually cause me to shed a tear. And what we're seeing actually now is more evidence that there's been a lot of speculation about whether or not she's going to be going soon, whether or not she'll last in number 10. And this afternoon, Graham Brady, who is the chair of the Conservatives' 1922 yes. Committee, the most important backbencher in Parliament, the barometer for the men in grey suits and women in grey suits, who will oversee her time of departure, has said that he backs her to remain Prime Minister until 2022. So essentially what we're seeing is that it's finally what I was talking about a couple of weeks ago. The party are rallying round her. Andrea Leadon's made similar noises as well. So this leadership contest, this next Conservative leadership contest, is going to be a marathon, not a sprint. Mm.
You say this is sort of humility, but is it forced humility? We were expecting her to be a little bit more contrite to some of the other Conservative MPs, particularly those former MPs who lost their seat as a result of calling the election. She didn't seem to make what seemed to be an apology. Then, of course, we had the different attitudes towards the visits towards the Grenfell Tower from Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn. She never seems to be getting ahead of the game at the moment. She seems to be sort of behind the curve the whole time, reacting to events rather than actually leading them.
She lost 9 key advisers in the wake of the general election, Simon. 33 Conservative MPs also lost their seats on that night. There were patches of gain to the party on the night as well. Walsall North, Middlesbrough South, retention of Copeland were notable highlights. But the Tories still lost their overall, if slim, majority in Parliament. But what she's been doing in the last few weeks has been putting in place the framework with the DUP deal, getting people into number 10, Craig Woodhouse, temporary as press secretary, Robbie Gibb, last week appointed as the new director of comms, are people who can actually help her get back on message here. And idea of giving an interview to the BBC really, I think, smacks of Mr. Gibb's influence, being smarter on the communications curve. There was a podcast where her previous comms director, Katie Perrier, talked about how the Prime Minister's failure to engage on social media created a vacuum, which the Labour Party have managed to successfully exploit as well. Theresa May's Twitter account doesn't follow anybody, which, you know, might have seemed authoritative at the time, but now looks out of touch in an era of modern communications. The Prime Minister's never going to be a personable individual. She's far too aloof and remote for that. But this small dose of humility will probably go a long way to salving her backbenches before they go off for the long summer recess. And don't let the heat and the Prosecco go to their heads, as David Lidington said, in terms of who might take over from her sooner than she'd want to.
Mm. The Conservatives have never been the most united party when they scent blood in the water. And while Theresa May be able to continue for a while we're talking about perhaps a leadership election that's more a marathon than a sprint, I mean, there is blood in the water. She's wounded. How long can the Conservatives, you feel, display a degree of unity? They're not, by and large, very good at doing that, are they?
I think the issue of Brexit is going to keep them united for now, and this is why I think she feels she has to commit to maintaining the largely unchanged stance that she put forward in the Lancaster House speech as well. Those around the cabinet table, though, are singing a very different song, particularly Philip Hammond. Even David Davis is reported to be more malleable as well. And I would suggest we probably see our first big concession of the Prime Minister's red lines over the Euratom issue. That's the Nuclear Regulatory Research body. Not an EU body itself, but a European body that the government is also committed to leaving. Notable Conservative rebels on this, including former Minister Ed Vasey. It's also worth noting now as well that the Treasury Select Committee, Parliament's main economic scrutiny body outside of the Public Accounts Committee, which covers spending, is now going to be chaired by pro-Remainer and arch-Theresa May critic Nicky Morgan as well.
So she beat out over Jacob Rees-Mogg.
She did, yes, and she's not in for an easy ride as well. Labour MPs wanted to see somebody who would be critical of the government in that post. It went to the Conservatives this time, and Ms Morgan, a former Treasury Minister, a former Cabinet Minister, fits that bill perfectly. But for now, I think this desire to retain Theresa May comes from what is really the overriding instinct of the Conservative Party, which is self-preservation. There is no obvious successor now. Despite David Davis being taunted by George Osborne's editorial in the Evening Standard this week to take over, he has no desire to do so, and he probably needs to be in the negotiating room as well. We can't really afford to have a situation where the Prime Minister and Chief Brexit negotiator are swapped at this time too. So it looks like Ms May will be kept in post now, but probably more as a figurehead than an actual figure of authority.
The impression one had of Theresa May when she was Home Secretary was rather a stronger, more determined, more purposeful woman than perhaps we've been getting of late. Was that impression wrong, do you think? We're now seeing the real Theresa May.
I think we have to give her some degree of credit because the day we're recording this is one year to the day that she's actually been in number 10 Downing Street.
Wow.
And she's dealt with more in the last 12 months than I think the most prime ministers deal with in their... I mean, I've followed politics since David Cameron took over in 2010, and I think the last years of the coalition, 2012 to 15, were comparatively dull compared to the last 12 months in politics. And Laura Kunzberg wrote a blog for the BBC where she lamented the fact that actually most observers and politicians in Westminster would actually welcome a period of respite, because the last 12 months we've seen not only a change of government but a change in the direction of this country. It's a generational shift, and of all the people that were standing tall just over 12 months ago, probably 30 months or so ago now, only Theresa May has really left standing. So the Conservative Party needs room, and arguably needs time to recover as well. I still believe that they'd be best served by taking a spell on the back benches, but that means a largely untested and, for many people, worrying positioned Labour Party taking its place. And it's yet to be proven that Jeremy Corbyn can command the majority of support in terms to win enough seats for an overall majority in Parliament itself. So maybe this is the best of a bad situation for the country as well in terms of stability, but I think perhaps the best we can hope from this is maybe a softening of the government's Brexit position.
It does seem quite extraordinary looking back. You can understand why Theresa May thought that it made sense to call an election. It was a 20-point lead she had. To actually fritter away or even cause to disappear a 20-point lead it's something of an achievement in itself. And when you think back how many commentators like you, and indeed how many ordinary people, were saying, don't keep banging on about strong and stable. Everybody, it became a laughing stock phrase almost immediately. That lady in Bristol, I've forgotten her
Brenda,
name now.
Brenda
in Bristol,
Brenda
almost
Bristol.
Straight away, put her head in her hands and said, oh, not again. She almost really set the tone for the whole election. That's what everybody thought within a few weeks, except, of course, politics wonks like you.
I won't say what I said when I heard Theresa May was calling an election. It's probably not repeatable on the radio, but I think we have to bear in mind this campaign will be picked over and dissected, but the emphasis that the Labour Party placed on reaching out to voters in different parts of the country did pay dividend for the party at that time. And we just have to look at the talk around tuition fees that's currently going on at the moment, with Labour MPs actually standing up, and in the week we're recording this as well, the Conservative Party has invited Labour to come in and offer them ideas on Brexit. Labour's gone one step further and is actually touting ideas from their manifesto as well. Now, whether or not we end up with a revised Brexit position, I strongly suspect we will see some concessions as well, but the broad direction of travel in terms of leaving the European Union remains unchanged. The only thing that can unseat Theresa May now, I think, is probably one of two things. I think the Grenfell inquiry and its handling by Sir Martin Morbeck and getting that off the ground in some form of redress is, if that's properly managed, that will help her last a little bit longer. But ultimately, as well, it's if Brexit delivers some form of cliff edge. This no yes. deal scenario is something she has to step away from now. The there is talk behind the scenes, from what I read, that the European Union and the British negotiators are able to reach some form of accommodation. But I think it means they've got to settle this issue of the Brexit divorce bill in the quiet month of August. Get it off the chest of the Conservative Party before the conference season rolls round. Get the Cabinet united behind a number that is acceptable, probably in the lower half of the 10 to 100 billion range that's been cited. 30, 40 billion would be acceptable. Work out what it is we want to continue participating in. Guarantee EU citizens' rights unilaterally. The government's not gone far enough on that yet. Stay in Euratom and possibly, dare I say it, even consider maintaining membership of the single market because there are enough Tory MPs who want that. But until the Labour Party changes its tune on that issue, it's a muddled stance. I don't think that's very likely.
Extraordinary, because of course we are now seeing things quietening down for summer. They've finished, I think, in Brussels now. You pointed out Tories going away and enjoying their holidays and not have overdosing on the Prosecco. But of course, when we come back, that's conference season.
Yes, it is. And we are... What will change, I think, as well, is there will be the select committees in Parliament will be up and running as well. And the Conservative Party conference will really be the first big leadership audition for the Cabinet. And indeed, some of those backbenchers as well. Because if Theresa May lasts till 2020, it's 1,760 days, I think, until the next election. Which doesn't sound like a long time, but bear in mind that in that time period, we're going to fit in a good chunk of that's going to be covered by this two-year Parliament. Mm. It's going to be covered by up to 800 to 1,000 statutory instruments as well that has to be passed in addition to the primary legislation to deliver Brexit. Mm. So in this five-year period, between now and the ending of any likely transition period that the UK is likely to need if we leave the European Union, a lot is going to change. And Theresa May, for all of her criticism she's come in from, she has demonstrated considerable staying power. And that is probably her biggest selling point for remaining in number 10 from her party's perspective, and probably for many in the country as well.
Well, we'll be back in a moment. We'll be talking about the Great Repeal Bill.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
We're talking politics. Joining me is Mike Indian, financial commentator, author of the blog The Groucho Tendency. We ought to talk then about the Great Repeal Bill, as it is called. Explain what's happening, because I suspect this is going to be one of those things that's going to make people's eyes just sort of glaze over, and yet really incredibly important. And you talk about all the legislation. I mean, gosh, it's going to require a great deal of logistical organisation, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it's first of all to say that we're on a third rebrand for this bill now. It started off as the Great Repeal Bill in David Davis's conference speech. It seems like eons ago now, last autumn in Birmingham. It then became, in the Queen's speech, rather more appropriate referred to as the Repeal Bill. And now the parliamentary draftsmen have got their hands on it. It's the European Union parenthesis withdrawal bill. But essentially what this bill does is it will repeal the European Communities Act 1972, which is the piece of legislation by which all European communities and EU law has become part of British law since we joined. It will also allow ministers powers to transpose existing EU legislation. But there's thousands of bits of this as well. I think estimates I've seen range between 8,000 to 15,000 pieces of EU directives that have been enacted into British law. And finally, this is the most controversial element, it will hand ministers the ability to make sweeping changes to these transposed laws and existing statute to make Brexit, in the words of the government, as smooth as possible.
What do you think the problems might be there? Because obviously the idea behind it originally is that we just make all these European laws British laws, and therefore we can gradually over time change the ones we don't want. But you're implying that there are possible, well, what's the phrase you use, but ways for ministers actually changing this without the proper scrutiny of the House?
Absolutely, and this is exactly what the bill proposes to do. You'll hear a lot of talk about so-called Henry VIII powers here, and there are two types of legislation. There are primary legislation, which pertains to acts of Parliament, and then there's secondary legislation, which is where ministers can make laws deriving powers from existing acts. Now, ministers love these, and the government, since 2010, has increasingly used this mechanism to make law in very small but very important areas, because the scrutiny it has to undergo between Parliament is largely negligible Most of these regulations that are laid thousands every year are subject to minimal oversight. At most, they are debated for up to 90 minutes in the House of Commons and the House of Lords. The scrutiny of them is largely technical. There is policy merit as well. But crucially, it allows ministers to make laws as they want to, really. There's a notable defeat on a tax credits one, which was in October 2015, which shows when it can go wrong. But mostly the government gets its own way with this. So to give you an idea of how many that will need to be passed, the government estimates in a quite complicated impact assessment that in order to make the necessary changes it claims are needed to ensure that the structures that it will need to set up, and I have to stress here, we don't know what these are yet, post-Brexit, for example, in regulators like, I don't know, nuclear energy, for example, because we're leaving Euratom, will need between 800 to 1,000 of these as well. Now, bear in mind that we pass, say, 3,000 of these a year. That's roughly a third of a year's worth of debates. That's a lot of important technical changes going under the radar here for both the public and Parliament.
So it sounds as if there's really almost too much to cope with in the time. As you point out, it's already over a year since the actual referendum. How much longer have we got in the 2 years that we've been given to actually negotiate Brexit?
We're down to 20 months now, and this is why the Great Repeal Bill is making its appearance this early in the Parliament. It hasn't been formally voted on yet. The government has only introduced it, but we've finally seen what the piece of legislation actually looks like. And as predicted, the most controversial elements are going to be the government's predicted reliance on using the so-called Henry VIII powers to actually amend existing law. Now, there's two waves to this, basically. Ministers will be, under the bill, if it's passed, ministers will be able to amend existing law that is relevant, and they deem that is relevant, that's in the key there, up until the date of Brexit, which is March 2019. And then afterwards, they can amend transposed EU laws for a further 2 years afterwards. Now, I can commend an article here on politics.co.uk by Ian Dunt. He's been a consistent critic of the legislation. He says there's
He's been a guest on Show Radio.
Ian says that there has never been a bill like this in modern British history, and he's quite right. And of course, we've got to remember the different political climate of this as well. Theresa May called this election in essence to consolidate her power and give herself a massive majority. Now it's a hung parliament, her authority is shattered. This is a massive power grab by the executive too, to make important changes in the way this country will be run without democratic oversight. You can see why quite a few people would have a problem with that.
Well, extraordinary. And talking of extraordinary things, we should probably talk about Jeremy Corbyn and Nicola Sturgeon, popping across to see Michel Barnier, who's in charge of the EU negotiations on Brexit. So what was the aim here, do you feel?
I think the aim is to really reflect the more complicated Brexit process that we're going to be seeing unfolding in the next few weeks over the summer and probably towards the end of the year as well. Don't forget, Jeremy Corbyn hopes that there will be an election in September that the Tories won't be able to hold together for more than a couple of months. And he's realistically positioning himself as the Prime Minister in waiting. For Nicola Sturgeon, it's really more a matter of trying to get back on the horse after the bruising blow of having to roll back on that second independence referendum. Her own Brexit Minister, Mike Russell, has been touring the Highlands and Islands this week trying to get the perspective from people in Scottish communities who will be affected by EU regulation as well. So on the one hand, for Corbyn, it's about positioning himself as a man who could potentially be taking over the Brexit process as well, and Keir Starmer, who'd be his chief negotiator. And for Nicola Sturgeon, it's really about ensuring that Scotland benefits from a further transfer of powers, and also making sure they've got a greater input into the process as well, beyond the current flimsy structures that they are asked to feed into.
Yes, of course, the thorny question of what would actually happen to Scotland and its role within the EU if Scotland did gain independence really has been pushed on the back burner, hasn't it?
Absolutely. If the general election did one good thing from the perspective of unionists, and Theresa May did one good thing, it's that it quashed the second independence referendum question, because the SNP lost 20 seats, no longer command the majority of support in Scotland, and the unionist parties all made gains. Hence why Ms Sturgeon rolled back on her pledge. But what we really need to bear in mind here, Simon, is that these are all critics of the government's Brexit approach as well. Mr Corbyn's approach to Brexit is largely an enigma. He does favour leaving the European Union.
Yes, because we have this odd thing that the leader of the Labour Party, although he's been quiet about it for a while, has in the past been much more of a Brexiteer than the Prime Minister, who is now in charge of the Brexit process.
And it's a constant source of frustration to me that Jeremy Corbyn has not been more honest about his Euroscepticism throughout as well. Now, friends I know that are members of the Labour Party tell me that it has an irreconcilable difficulty with this, as it does on immigration. But I think it's time for the party to grow up and really own up to the fact that it's offering a really an impossible choice on Brexit, namely their commitment to remain within the single market and also end freedom of movement. As I've said before, those two aims are not compatible. It is fundamentally dishonest of them to continue to peddle this inside their manifesto.
You talk about this as if this is the first time politicians might not have been totally honest. Clearly you still are rather idealistic and hope that politicians will actually be more open. You can see why he has a problem, I suppose.
Absolutely, but I would remind Mr. Corbyn that he ran on the slogan of straight talking honest politics, and I think many people believe that's his primary concern. He is fundamentally honest on many other issues. He hasn't shied away from hiding his concerns in other areas. But I think it's also an issue, as you've already said, don't forget the big rebellion of this small parliament so far has been Labour over the single market, as we saw with the Queen's speech. Nicola Sturgeon, however, faces a very different challenge now as well. One, that the fact that her own scrutiny of how she runs Scotland is under greater pressure as well. She's facing a more articulate opponent in the form of Ruth Davidson. Yes. The Conservatives in Scotland are making gains. They have now 13 MPs in Westminster. The SNP lost many heavy hitters like Angus Robertson at the election, and they can no longer claim to be the party that speaks for all of Scotland as well. What they can do, however, is try and make sure that their voices in the process are heard. They want the powers on agriculture, environment, fisheries as well that will be devolved. And this comes back, as we were talking previously, to the Great Repeal Bill. There's something of a fudge in here as well, which means that Westminster will decide which powers go back to them as well. You can see why, given a unionist Conservative government in Westminster, one that's going to dictate the terms of powers, Holyrood, Cardiff Bay and Stormont, when it reconvenes, are worried that they may not get the powers that they rightly deserve. Mm-hmm.
Let's go back then to the Conservatives and unity. There was a degree of ruction earlier this week as Conservative MPs realised that Theresa May was trying to appeal to Jeremy Corbyn, coming to some. What was the aim of Theresa May wanting to talk to Corbyn about the Brexit process?
Likely Lib Dem leader in waiting, Vince Cable, said she was seeking a grand coalition, a German-style grand coalition with the Labour Party over Brexit as well. Because fundamentally, this is an area which they broadly agree upon. Both leaders want to see the result of the referendum implemented. But as I've said before, the referendum was not a mandate for a particular type of Brexit. The details haven't been fleshed out here.
Yes.
The Conservatives have a very firm vision, if hardline. Labour's is woollier, but they are seeking concessions, for example, the incorporation of the European Charter on Fundamental Charter on Human Rights into UK law, which it looks like they're going to fight.
Yes.
There'd be some parliamentary guerrilla warfare on that.
Because Jeremy Corbyn's opposition to the EU comes from a completely different place, and with how honest he's being or not, than it used to. And in fact, one forgets that Labour for a long time were very anti the EU, often published online in Tony Blair's first election leaflet, talking about how the EU sort of destroyed jobs. It was seen as being corporatist and somehow in line with big business in the old days, wasn't it?
And I wouldn't say Jeremy Corbyn's being dishonest. I would say that he just doesn't talk about it. And I know I said he was fundamentally dishonest before. I meant in the wording of the manifesto.
He's trying to avoid, certain other touchy subjects, he's trying to avoid it.
He leaves it to his shadow cabinet to talk about. And I think, given it's like during the referendum campaign, I went to a Labour speech last year, and, you know, his support for the European Union was summed up in that 7 out of 10 comment as well. At least with Theresa May, you have no doubt about where she stands on the issue of Brexit and what kind of Brexit she wants. You can question whether or not it's good for the country. That's entirely up to the individual to decide. But with Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party, most likely poised to be the next government, whether it's this year or in 4 or 5 years' time, I think, there's still a chance that for them to firm up their position, to be more honest. But of course, they need to hold together their coalition of young people, angry Remainers, and those die-hard working-class supporters who are immigration sceptic as well. Three very different camps to reconcile there, Simon.
Yes, yes.
And of course, expensive pledges like tuition fees to implement as well. But what we need to bear in mind here, as we draw ever deeper into these negotiations, is that we have to keep our eyes on getting a good trade deal from Europe as well. And that means reconciling for both parties that some sort of softening of a position on immigration is inevitable if we're going to get the best terms of trade with the largest single market in the world.
Fascinating, Mike. Thank you. Fascinating times, indeed. I've been talking to Mike Indian, financial commentator, author of the blog The Groucho Tendency.
The Bigger Picture. going behind the headlines of the biggest economic and political stories of the day.